This is a CBC podcast. From the smallest subatomic particles to the largest objects in the sky, Quirks and Quarks is there. Every week, host Bob McDonald presents the people behind the latest discoveries in the physical and natural sciences. Go to cbc.ca/quirks for podcasts, downloads, and more.
Hello, I'm Stuart McLean, and this is the Vinyl Cafe. I was visiting a friend the other day, and I was staring at her fridge. Not in her fridge, but at it. The fridge is festooned with things. There are, in fact, several layers of paper stuck to my friend's fridge, each layer older than the one above it. I've stared at it many times before, both in awe and in envy, but the last time I was over, something new caught my eye. Well, something old, actually. The thing that caught my eye this time was a letter. It's a famous letter, or famous enough that it has a name. It's known as the Bixby letter. It was written by President Abraham Lincoln to Lydia Bixby, a widow who lived in Boston, Massachusetts. When my friend caught me reading the letter, she looked at me and she said, "I think that's the greatest letter ever written." It goes like this. Washington, November 21st, 1864. Dear Madam, I have been shown in the files of the War Department a statement that you are the mother of 5 sons who have died gloriously on the field of battle. I feel how weak and fruitless must be any word of mine which should attempt to beguile you from the grief of a loss so overwhelming. But I cannot refrain from tendering you the consolation that may be found in the thanks of the Republic they died to save. I pray that our Heavenly Father may assuage the anguish of your bereavement and leave you only the cherished memory of the loved and lost and the solemn pride that must be yours to have laid so costly a sacrifice upon the altar of freedom. Yours, very sincerely and respectfully, A. Lincoln. Right to the point and right to the heart, heartfelt and concise. Is it the greatest letter ever written? I don't know about that. I've read many great letters over the years, and there are no doubt many more crying to be read, especially the unpublished ones, the letters someone somewhere once decided were worth keeping and which have spent the last 10, 20, or 200 years sitting in shoeboxes or filing cabinets. That letter may not even be Lincoln's best letter. The letter he wrote to A.G. Hodges 3 years into the Civil War, the letter that begins, "If slavery is not wrong, nothing is wrong." I'd put forward that letter gives the Bixby letter a run for its money. I have a letter framed and hanging by my desk that one of my heroes once wrote to one of his fans, a letter from E.B. White to a certain Mr. Greeson. "Thank you for your pleasant note about the book," writes White. "I'm glad it filled some hours, and sorry that you had to take it instead of the chores. That scow, by the way, was swiped by an Indian last week who needed something to go duck shooting in. Yesterday I rowed around the shore till I found it and stole it back. It's the first time I've ever stolen anything away from an Indian. It gave me a queer feeling, even though I was the rightful owner." That may not be great. White would never claim greatness for it, but it makes me smile when I read it, for its gentle, understated, and self-deprecating humor. Several years ago, a friend of mine gave me a letter penned by the inimitable Stephen Leacock. "I just keep the wolf away from the door," writes Leacock at letter's end, by way of summing up what he's been up to. "I just keep the wolf away from the door," writes Leacock, by shooting ink at him. The letter may not be great, but that's a great turn of phrase. Words are powerful tools, especially in the hands of wordsmiths of the caliber of Stephen Leacock and E.B. White. When fit together in the right order, words can heal, comfort, enrage, inspire, and even demonstrate love. Today on the show, we're going to muck about in the world of words. We're going to celebrate letters. words put down on a page and sent by post, words that are most often meant for one pair of eyes only. We're going to celebrate the quiet and private and personal art of the letter and letter writing. I try to write a letter a day. I fall short, but one a day is my intention, and by holding that intention, my intention is not to fall short by too far. I do this, well, truth be told, probably I do this because I'm a writer, and I can't help myself. Writers become writers because they are awkward, and the awkward task of putting words on a page is how writers communicate best. But I also do it because there is gravitas to a letter, any letter. It says, the thoughts herein, frivolous or otherwise, considerable or sparse, were considered. So consider them yourself. They have, after all, been signed, sealed, and delivered. And that is not a trivial thing. What's been put down on paper cannot be walked away from. Did I say, I love you? Did I sign my name to that? I can walk as far as I want, but I can't walk away. When I say write, I don't mean necessarily that I handwrite my letters. I type a lot of them, and I include those in the written category. In fact, I type most of my letters, sometimes even on a typewriter. I have several that I use, including one that types in cursive. Mostly, however, I write on my computer. I write and print and sign them, and then I slip them in an envelope, and then I set to work on the envelope, because you can judge a book by its cover. I want the envelopes to deliver both a sense of wonder and anticipation, so I attend to them, too. The addresses, both my return in the top left and the main one, balanced as carefully as I can balance them. The stamps, carefully aligned so their edges are straight with a margin. Dealers will actually sell you old stamp collections at a discount of their face value. Postage, it's called. And I have a box of old and unused postage that is legal tender. And sometimes I use the old stamps. You need more than one, of course, so you end up with a little forest of stamps. And if I'm being especially attentive, I'll add something to the back of the envelope. I have a collection of rubber stamps on my desk, some from old postal services, others of more whimsical images, a turtle, a roadhouse waitress, a cloud. And the effect I'm going for with the front and the back is of something that looks as though it might have been posted a decade or two ago, a letter that, on first glance, you might think has gone astray, an old-fashioned-looking thing. For setting pen to paper is, after all, an old-fashioned impulse. Interestingly, in that old-fashioned time, there was nothing old-fashioned about it at all. In the time I'm trying to conjure, letter writing was the most efficient way of moving your thoughts around. Back then, there were two deliveries a day. You could invite someone to dinner in the morning post, and they could accept in the afternoon. But that's back when there were postal cars on trains and letters were sorted as they rattled through the night, an efficiency we have lost and, to be fair, no longer need. The temptation these days, of course, is to send an email, and I send plenty, but there are occasions when an email is not up to the task. A thank you note, for instance. Thank you notes should always be handwritten and sent immediately. And though they're short and easily done, these little cards we send to thank one another for dinners or gifts or for kindnesses extended are not so easily done that I don't count them among my letter a day. And you can't send a letter of condolence by email. A letter of condolence should not be a thing of efficiency nor of impermanence. It must linger, for the lost one lingers no more. And a letter gives the bereaved something to linger over, and lingering is all they want in the sad, sorrowful time of mourning. And that brings us to the love letter. How else can a boy tell a girl that he loves her if not in a letter? With roses, you say? The rose petals folded over and over like a mystery, a lovely yellow rose that whispers in the language of the flowers, I love you so very, very much? Yes, the whispering yellow rose can say I love you more than anything, but a wine-stained letter written late at night and then sealed with a kiss gets to the heart of the matter. Roses wither and die, and even though you may dry them and dust them and keep them in a vase, they will fade away forgotten, for roses come by the dozen, and a letter comes by hand, handed to you after being handed from one to another. Not a rose, maybe, but a daisy chain of love. You can put flowers in a vase, but you can slip your letter under your pillow, or put it in a box by your bed with all the other letters your true love sent, and any time your heart skips a beat, you can pull out the box and read them again and again. A letter does not vacillate. It does not change its mind. If it is remorseful, it stays that way, happy to repeat its sorry little self whenever you ask it to. Its love does not fade. Its friendship does not wane. If it's proud of you, it'll remain proud over the years. It is the candle on the kitchen table, the lantern in the window. It is a connection, a reaching out, both a giving and a receiving. And after it declares itself, it asks you to declare yourself in return. And P.S., no matter what your letter says, no matter what the purpose of the words, a letter, every letter, says something beyond words. For it says this: you may not have known, but someone's been thinking of you. And in this sad, sorry world, sometimes that is all you need to hear. And if you're just tuning in, you may have guessed it, but we're talking about letter writing today on the Vinyl Cafe. And speaking of letters, it's time now for the Vinyl Cafe Story Exchange. Well, you know how this works. This is the part of the show where you send us your stories. They have to be true stories, and they have to be short, but after that, they don't have to be anything at all. After that, it's up to you. We promise we'll read everything you send us, and we promise we'll read some of our favorites here on the radio. If we choose to read your story on the radio, we promise we'll send you a copy of our latest book. It's called Revenge of the Vinyl Cafe. We have a story today from Kayla Fireman of Ottawa, Ontario. Dear Stuart, writes Kayla, when I was 11 years old, I complained that I never got any mail. After weeks of listening to me, my father was spurred into action. One day, I got a letter from him. He mailed it from his office. And thus began a pen pal correspondence that lasted a year and a half. I would mail my letters to my father's office, and he would mail his reply to me at home. We wrote about many things. We discussed politics, arts and culture, and, of course, my allowance. It was wonderful having a pen pal. I looked forward to my dad's letters. That was when I was 11. Today, I'm a middle-aged baby boomer headed towards my retirement. My father took a late retirement himself only 5 years ago. Around that time, he drove over to my place one evening, knocked on the door, and handed me a package. He'd been clearing out his office and had come across a bundle of letters in the back of a drawer. The letters I'd written him as a young girl. I couldn't believe he'd kept them all these years. And so I sat down and read them that evening with tears and lots of laughter. One said, "Thanks for the dollar allowance. It'll do fine until I need some more." Another one asked about a recent election result. It said, "If a candidate gets a minority, do they still get to run the country?" I was a shy girl. I was not one to express a lot of emotion. But on one postcard, I'd written a P.S. It said, "I've got a secret to tell you. I love you, Dad." As I read through the letters, I pictured him back then, a young doctor building a career, supporting a wife and three growing children, yet finding the time and taking the initiative to make his daughter feel important. So I sat down one more time, and I wrote my father another letter. I thanked him for being a sensitive, caring parent who made such a difference in my life. I told him he made me feel special, and his thoughtfulness had meant so much to me. I ended the letter with a P.S. P.S., I wrote, I got a secret to tell you. I love you, Dad. The story came to us from Kayla Fireman of Ottawa, Ontario. So I met my friend Paul at summer camp. Paul was a canoe tripper, most famous for the summer he abandoned his campers for 3 days alone and unsupervised on an island in La Vérendrye Wildlife Reserve. He left them there so he could hitchhike to Montreal and write a makeup exam. He hadn't told the camp director because he was afraid he wouldn't be hired if they knew about his personal detour. Don't leave the island, he told his campers, and off he slipped. He rejoined them and they finished the trip, but he didn't get them back to base camp until several days late, enough days that the camp director was, well, let's just say the camp director was worried. They actually swam rather than paddled into camp, having abandoned their canoes and hitchhiked the last 50 miles, but that's another story. I loved Paul, and he was more responsible than that summer tale would lead you to believe. He was older than me, and he introduced me to many things, to the pleasures of the Sunday morning sermons of the Reverend Leonard Mason at the Montreal Unitarian Church, and to the pleasure of the fiction of John D. MacDonald and his beach bum protagonist, Travis McGee, to the satisfaction of balsa wood modeled planes, and finally, to stamp collecting. Paul used to collect what are known as plate blocks, which are the four attached corner stamps torn from one corner of a sheet of stamps, the upper left or right corner or any of the four corners, which include not only the stamps, but the margin or border of the sheet on which information about the stamp is printed. Because Paul did it, it wasn't long before I decided I, too, would collect plate blocks. I think we believed that one day our collections would be valuable, that these plates of four stamps would be sought after by collectors. Or maybe we were just indulging in the joy that comes from collecting things. The point is, Paul did it, and so did I. So every time the post office released a new stamp, I'd buy a plate block of four and put them away. Stamps only cost 8 cents in those days, and there was great satisfaction in getting something of value, or something I believed valuable anyway, for four stamps times 8 cents each. For 32 cents. I don't recall how often new stamps were issued, maybe once a month, nor do I remember how long I was a collector, maybe a year, maybe two. But I do remember this. In the late autumn of 1972, the post office issued a stamp honoring Cornelius Kreekhoff. Kreekhoff was a painter. Dutch-born, he came to Canada in the 19th century and painted mostly outdoor scenes. Most of them, it seems to me, done in winter. Snowshoers and sleighs, that sort of thing. The Kreekhoff stamp was a reproduction of one of his most famous paintings, The Blacksmith's Shop. So the Kreekhoff stamp was released, and I went down to my local post office and I bought my little block of four and I added it to my collection. It was undoubtedly Paul who told me about the error. Whether he discovered it himself or heard about it somewhere, I don't know. Stewie! Paul used to call me Stewie. No one else has ever called me that. I couldn't stand it if they did. But that's what Paul called me, and I loved it. Stewie! There's an error on the Kreekhoff. Both on the stamp itself and in the marginalia. On the stamp, there was a broken door frame on the blacksmith's shed. On the paper border of the sheet, the border included in my block, the printer had misspelled Kreekhoff's last name. They had reversed the E and the I, or vice versa. This, of course, was our dream come true. Or that's what I thought. I don't know the lingo, but it meant we had a rarity, a variant, a one-of-a-kind. My four little stamps would be worth something. Of course, we tried to buy more, or I did, but no more were available. Real collectors had bought them all. And so autumn became winter, and winter turned to spring, and Paul and I continued going to classes, and to church, and to the Stanley Tavern, and to camp in the summer, and we continued to buy stamps, and we graduated, and we went our separate ways. And one day, this is a few years later, a lifetime in those boyhood days, one day, I found myself in Banff, Alberta. I was staying at the Banff Center, attending a one-month summer conference of some description. I have no memory of exactly what. I was working in the student services department of Dawson College, so it had to have something to do with student services, but truthfully, it had more to do with taking the train across the country and spending 3 weeks in Banff. I had a girlfriend at the time, my first, a girl who I'd met at camp, where I'd met Paul. And one day, those being the days before email and cell phones, I wrote the girl a letter, and I took myself down to the Banff post office to mail it. "One stamp, please," I said. The man behind the counter handed me a stamp with the face of the Queen, the everyday Queen stamp. Now, I was no longer a stamp collector, but my collecting days had awakened a certain fancy, a fancy that lingers today. As fond as I am and was of Her Majesty, I fancied the special issues. "Do you have anything other than the Queen?" I asked. The Queen, after all, would be there tomorrow. The clerk smiled. "Yes, we do," he said. And he reached into the drawer under the counter and he pulled out a sheet of the Krieghoffs. "Just one," he said. Words can't explain the way I felt at that moment. I tried to stay cool, but I wasn't cool. I was shaking. Here's what had happened. In those days, you could only buy special issues like the Krieghoff stamp at post offices with special counters. It turned out that the Banff post office was supposed to open a special counter back in 1972, but they hadn't gotten around to it. Head office, who assumed they were up and running, had been sending them all the special issues, and they'd been storing them in the basement. They had opened the counter the week I arrived. "We have sheets of these down in the basement," said the clerk. "You mean I could buy more?" "You could buy as many as you want." Now, as far as I understood, I was the prospector who had just kicked the rock, and it was lying there at my foot, all golden and sparkling in the sun. I had found a gold mine. Oil was gushing from the ground. I would buy all the stamps from the Banff post office, sell them at a fabulous profit, and I would be rich beyond my wildest dreams. I had enough money in my pocket for two complete sheets. I bought them. By the time I got back to the Banff Center, to my room, it was evening. By the time I figured out what to do, it was later in the evening. If I was going to spend all my money on stamps, if I was going to clean them out, sorry, if I was going to invest all my money in stamps, I had to make sure I was making a wise investment. I needed to call a stamp dealer and see how much they would pay for the hundreds of sheets that I understood to be in the Banff post office basement. I decided I shouldn't call a dealer in nearby Calgary. That might tip my hand. They might figure out where I was and buy the stamps out from under me. I decided I would call my father and have him ask a Montreal dealer. That would be safer. Because of the time difference, my parents were asleep when I called. A phone call in the middle of the night is never a comfortable thing. And I was calling collect from a phone booth. It was my sleepy father who accepted the charges. "I need you to wake up," I said, sounding no doubt as if something was horribly wrong. "I need you to wake Mom up, and I need both of you to get on the line." Something actually was wrong. I was more or less out of my mind. My mother, of course, didn't need to be woken. The phone had done that. I could hear her in the background. "Who is it?" she was asking. "Is everything all right?" They each got on an extension, and I told them my story. My father wasn't impressed. "I'm very busy," he said. "I can't do this tomorrow. Call me Friday." Friday was 3 days away. During those 3 days, I barely slept. How could I sleep? I had no time for sleep. I was too busy trying to decide how I'd live my life now that I was going to be fabulously wealthy. Instead of sleeping, I paced. My father phoned on Friday. "Your stamps aren't worth anything," he said. Did I detect a sense of satisfaction? Did he seem pleased to tell me this? He explained to me that the stamp dealer he had visited had explained to him that everyone had known the error on the stamp from the get-go and that all the dealers and all the collectors had accumulated enough. There was a glut of Krieghoffs. The catalog might list them as worth 4 times their face value, but no one was going to pay it. There was no market for them. I didn't believe him, of course. I decided my father hadn't taken me seriously. I decided he hadn't really checked, or if he had, he hadn't checked hard enough. There is nothing like the conviction of the convinced. I decided I'd buy some more of the stamps anyway. Maybe not all of them, but you know, a modest investment. What did my father know? When I got back to the post office, there were, of course, none left. "Oh," said the clerk, "some guy from Calgary came up and bought them all. Apparently, there's an error in the printing. Apparently, they're worth something." Just as I suspected. And so, like it is with all get-rich-quick schemes, I didn't get rich quick. But I didn't go home empty-handed either. I had the 2 sheets that I'd bought that first afternoon. I framed one and stuck the other in the back of the frame for safekeeping. I hung them in my office. Over the years, they became a favorite conversation piece. Whenever anyone asked, I'd tell them this story, the story I just told you, of how for 3 days I thought I was about to become rich beyond belief. It was my how I almost got rich story, and I used to tell it with great passion and to some effect. Turns out I didn't. Almost get rich, I mean. Turns out my father was right. As it has turned out that he was right about so many things, like how to live a good life and the dubious value of getting rich quick. I called a dealer recently and asked him what my plate block might be worth today. He told me the catalog price was $3 for the 4 stamps from the upper right corner, which means in 40 years my 32-cent investment has increased tenfold, about the rate of inflation. Though, not really. "That's the catalog price," said the dealer. "There are lots of Krieghoffs around. You could buy them for half that." "But what about if I was selling?" I asked. "What would you pay me for a basement full of them?" "I would offer you less than face value," said the dealer. I still have the framed stamps. And from time to time, I still tell the story. But not with so much gusto. Paul died 5 years ago, and I didn't get to say goodbye. And as I have said before on this show, I miss him. I wish he was here. He left me richer. I am a richer man for having known him, or my life has been richer. And my life is poorer now that he's gone. And these days, when I look at my framed stamps, that is what I'm reminded of the value of friendship and of the sorrow that comes when friends must part. I would trade a vault of stamps for more time with Paul, and with my father, too, who I doubted, and who, like Paul, is gone. I have my stamps, and they are valuable. It turns out they have made me rich beyond belief, because they lead me back to them. Well, that's about all the time we have for today's show. Before I go, I should tell you about where we're heading over the next few months. In April, we'll be taking the Vinyl Cafe on the road doing live concerts in Clinton Township, Michigan, Bay City, Michigan, Indianapolis, Indiana, Cleveland, Ohio, and Windsor, Ontario. In May, June, and July, we'll be making stops in St. John's, Newfoundland, and Labrador, Almont, Ontario, and Danceland in Manitou Beach, Saskatchewan. You can check our website for all the details on all of these shows, and you can find us online at vinylcafe.com or check us out on Facebook. David Amers, the founding producer of the Vinyl Cafe, Greg DeClute is the recording engineer, Louise Curtis is the production assistant, Julie Penner is the music producer, Meg Masters is my long-suffering story editor. The Vinyl Cafe is produced by Jess Milton. I'm Stuart McLean. So long for now.
Looking for more CBC podcasts? Go to cbc.ca/podcasting.